You're listening to The Vint Podcast, where we bring you interviews and stories from around the world of wine and spirits. From winemakers and critics to sommeliers and master distillers, we'll explore the people and businesses who are instrumental in shaping the future of today's food and drinks culture. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Vint Podcast. My name is Brady, without Billy Galanko here in the studio today, which just means I have free reign over the podcast and got to go back into our archives and pull out an interview from about a year ago, one of my favorite episodes that we've done so far, with one of my favorite guests, Bobby Stuckey. Bobby is well-known as a master sommelier, has had a career dedicated to the restaurant industry. So this interview today focuses a lot around what it means to make service and make hospitality a career, especially at the level that he's at, having achieved, you know, the highest designation in his field as Master Sommelier. So we talk about service as a career. We talk about the wines of Friuli, which is a region that Bobby is deeply passionate about, travels there often, has deep connections to the region. He's going to introduce us to some of the wines of the region, to the food culture of the region, and ultimately we'll discuss the restaurants and sort of the philosophy behind his Frasca Hospitality Group, which draws inspiration from the food culture of the region as well. Bobby's team has had a really busy last year. The Michelin Guide came to Colorado and awarded their flagship restaurant, Frasca, their first Michelin star, as well as the team an outstanding service award. And they're opening a new restaurant here in 2024, which should come either later this summer or later this fall, Osterica Alberico. Bobby was also a boon for the restaurant industry during the pandemic in 2020, raising money, lobbying in D.C. on behalf of restaurant workers and the restaurant industry. Had to have saved countless restaurants and bars from closing during that time through his advocacy. And he's just a tireless supporter of restaurants and the restaurant worker. His education, his teaching, you can find videos and articles that he's written on hospitality and wine service. Super inspirational for anyone who is interested in food and wine in the restaurant scene or who obviously is a part of the service industry. Bobby is proof that you can build a long and lasting, a sustainable and fulfilling career in the hospitality industry. And I think that he provides great encouragement on this episode for more folks to do that. And we'd love to see the same. So please enjoy this interview from the archives with Master Sommelier Bobby Stuckey. Hey, Bobby, thanks for joining us. We're thrilled to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Brady and Billy. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is great. We get to talk with folks across the industry, producers, critics, winemakers, and regional experts as well, folks in business. And it's pretty rare that we get to talk to someone who's ingrained in the hospitality industry, the restaurant business, and who's given so much to that side of the industry. I think it's often overlooked in some of these conversations. So appreciate to have you on. Certainly the voice of that industry, it seems like, over the last 3 or 4 years, especially through COVID.
Thanks for having me on. Can't wait to catch up.
Yeah, why don't we start? I don't want to go too deep because people obviously can find some of like your background and stuff elsewhere and can read up on that. But why don't you give us some, starting wherever it makes most sense for your story to start, and tell our listeners just how you came into the industry and how you moved into working on the kinds of things you're spending most time on today.
Yeah, I think it to start really at the beginning. First of all, I have to say I'm so lucky that the hospitality or the restaurant industry found me, or I found it, or however you want to figure that out. This August will be 40 years of me bussing tables. I started as a bus person in August of 1983. So if you do that simple math, that's 40 years, and I will be bussing tables this August. So not a lot has changed, but a lot has changed. So that's really how it started. And for me as a kid, or now as a grown adult, being able to look back on that, I was a kid who was very motivated to be good at school, but I wasn't very good at school. I am of that generation. I was born in 1969, so I'm in my mid-50s. I was in Arizona. They were maybe – I didn't get diagnosed as being dyslexic until my freshman year in college. So here I was in 7th and 8th and during high school trying my hardest, and I was really struggling academically. And this goes out to anybody who's a young person struggling to find their place. Whenever you find something that positively gives you positive reinforcement, it can be a great positive snowball. And I remember finding busing tables, and it was something that I liked. And I got positive reinforcement. And it just, one thing led to another. I remember the first night I got to expedite as a high school, a teenager. I just felt so good that there was something that I was able to get positive reinforcement from.
It's almost like, I feel like there's been this culture for a long time and probably still persists in a lot of places where you graduate from service or you graduate from the floor in some way in the restaurant industry and have run counter to that in that you're obviously at the top of your game in a lot of ways and still committing night after night to refining that. Yeah. What can you speak to that at all? Do you see that as sentiment in the industry and how did you,
like, what made you kind of begin? Brady, that's a great question. I don't think it's interesting. I think people look at me as a little awkward because I'm still so engaged in being on the floor. And so many people roll their eyes and are like, how can this still be going on? It just happened last night. I was taking care of a table and they're like, I can't believe you're still here doing this. And that's always a head scratcher for me. I love doing it, so it's easy for me. But I also understand in our industry, it might be tough for people to continue for a myriad of reasons. A, if you're going to be in hospitality, in restaurants, working in evenings, it's not a fair deck of cards. If I was an emergency room surgeon and I had to work at night, which all emergency room surgeons do, and they can do it for their whole career, there's not as much friction. You don't have family members upset. You don't have your girlfriend or wife or boyfriend or college roommate upset. And the thing about the restaurant industry is someone will have problems with your career choice or many. And that's hard on people. So then people artificially think the industry is harder than it really is. And we just have to be self-reflective. If this is your industry, you got to be honest with that dialogue with your loved ones and say, this is what's going on. I am very lucky that I have a very supportive partner, my wife, Danette Stuckey, and she knows how important it is to me, and she's very supportive.
I think that's a point that I've never really thought about before is I've had a lot of friends who've worked hospitality and a lot, I think, and when you're younger, especially, part of those late night shifts happen to fall on the weekends. And that's when your friends or people are more available to do stuff. But I never really thought about it compared to the medical side. I think that's really interesting. But something that I've always heard, and a lot of my friends, they become so invested, especially as they move up in a certain restaurant or genre. How have you been able to both stay on the floor and stay engaged while also creating and expanding your kind of the restaurants and the properties that you've opened?
There's definitely times where there's a break point too. And I don't have a title on my business card, but I guess if you did an org chart, I might fall maybe in that CEO piece. We have 250 employees. We're growing our company. Just as much as I have a very supportive partner, my life partner, I also have a very supportive partnership from Lachlan and Peter, my two business partners, but also our director team, Aaron Palmer, Alicia, Jody, Carlin, Eduardo. They're also very supportive of my weirdness about wanting to be on the floor. So we have to delegate other things so there's not too much of a break point. But it is hard and there's friction and there's times where, you know, someone says, Bobby, you can't maybe have one less night on the floor or whatever so we can get more stuff accomplished. Those are real conversations. You just have to be aware of that.
Yeah, and for every conversation or article I see, when someone's chatting with you or Frosk is sharing some content or content from you, I see that's wine and hospitality and restaurants and is also like endurance sports and running. I know that's a big passion for you. Do you feel like they're complementary kind of pursuits? It has to be in a way. And like some of the physical demands and like consistency that you need in both of those areas. Do you see it that way? Or how do you think about that?
I see it in two steps. No matter what it is, you have to have it doesn't matter what you do for a job. You have to have an out of work, away from work passion. I think in our industry, what happens too much is people stay in their bubble of hospitality, and then their friends are hospitality people, and then that's their whole world. And that's fine, but it's more enriching to have other people in your universe doing other things. So I think that's one part. So find something that you love. Look at my, I only have one other restaurateur in my running group, but they're all different. I've got realtors, I've got bankers, I've got accountants, I've got physicians, and that's just a bunch of different stimuli. So that's really fun. I literally walking in here, Aaron Palmer and my business partner, Peter, and I were talking about some intel that I got from one of my running partners. That wouldn't happen, running friends, had I just stayed just with restaurant people all the time. So I think that to build out your universe or your solar system or whatever, really important. Also, I think you have to take care of yourself in this industry. I think it's really important. Find things to cause that balance. I've been saying this for a long time. I've actually been saying this since the late 90s. Our industry isn't that hard of an industry. We make it too hard on ourselves by self-inflicting pain, by going out too late at night and doing all these things. And I really enjoy having my other outlets. And then the last piece on that, having process of growth, process of all these things. If you have something outside of work that also makes you do process, so I use an example. I like to run a marathon once or twice a year, usually once a year, unless I can really negotiate with my wife for a second one. But I need to take, at my age, I'm in my mid-50s, I've got to lay out 18 weeks of my free time to be able to successfully do a marathon. When you do that for your free time, it lets you be very process-oriented in many other things, too.
It was it pretty recent that you said the 90s, like you were preaching that, but was that the point where you really figured out that balance and that became a priority for you, or was it even more recent than that, that you felt like it took maybe 30 years to get to that mindset?
I started running when I was 7. My dad took me to my first 10K in 1976.
Oh, wow.
The Papago Park 10K, and I proudly wore my 10K running shirt. I was such a little guy that it went down to my knees like a dress. So I've been running since then. What happened was I was working in the mid-90s in Aspen, Colorado at the Little Nell. I was the wine director. Aspen can be known for a very Peter Pan-esque party scene. And I was studying for my I had just passed my advanced exam and I wanted to study for the quartermaster sommelier exam. And I had a really big job. Wine director at the Little Nell is a big position. Takes a lot of wattage. There's a lot going on. And I first started by saying, hey, and I was in a company, the Nell, there were a lot of people much older than me. So I could see either mistakes or positives people were doing. And I paid attention. And it was right during the time period when every journalist was writing about Marco Pierre White being a party boy chef and all this. And I said, what I first did was late 98, early 99. I said, I'm only going to go out after work on Saturdays when I don't work on Sundays, if I didn't have work the next day. That was how my first step. And then all of a sudden, I started feeling more like the job was easier all of a sudden. And then I just, by mid-1999, I just said, I'm just not going out after work. And that's not to say I'm a prude and I don't drink wine or drink beer or margarita or whatever, but you don't see me going out to a bar after work or ever, ever. And what that has allowed me to do is really realize that this industry isn't as hard as we think it is. People make it harder on themselves. And it's interesting. It's taken a long time for food journalism, and they're still not out of it yet. They're still enamored with the low-hanging fruit of writing about the party boy chef or the party boy sommelier. And that's just not productive. If you're going to be at this industry a long time, you got to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
On that real quick, Wine Spectator did a great article this spring. I'm a little piece in it, but it's a broad stroke across people with different energies or different passions outside of their main job in the wine or hospitality industry from around the world. It's got winemakers in Tuscany, Napa, all over. And it's a really, people should be writing articles like that a lot more. So a lot more young people in our industry can see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense. Just one kind of tangential question. It's something that bothers me about recreational runners. Not that I'm a runner. How far can you run and still be chatting with the person you're running with during the run? I see a lot of people around. I live in LA and people are on runs and they're just chatting the whole time.
That has to do with the stimuli of what you're doing that day. So if just a little running geek speak, I think some of the greatest marathon runners historically come from East Africa, either Ethiopia or Kenya. I'm actually friends with some people from both of those countries. And what you might do is multiple days of your running week can be at a very low intensity. Like I use the example of Edna Kiplagat, who a couple of years ago won the Boston Marathon. On her easy days, it's very easy for 50-some-year-old Bobby to run and talk with her. But I can't run with her on her really hard days or moderately hard days, let's be honest. If you run, if most of your running is low intensity and then you add intensity, which I think is very important to do one day a week or whatever, depending on what you're trying to accomplish, do most of your running at low intensity and then pepper in one day a week or one day every 10 days of very intense, vigorous intensity. A, your running's better. It's actually really better for you as a human being. Nothing against CrossFit and all these like high impact things. That's really not the best way to build your chassis as a human being. It really should be lower intensity with really measured high intensity. Not that. And as you get older, you can't do it as often either.
Yeah, I remember when I was still doing team. When I was doing team running back in school, we would have multiple days a week where we would do barely jogging. Like it's maybe 30% effort, but it'd be an hour long and we would sing the whole time. And yeah. I felt the best after some of those runs than any of our workouts or even shorter workouts, like 20-minute, 30-minute track workouts would feel. Nothing like, you know, what that hour long run and really expanding your lungs would feel like. I think that's good running wisdom. This is a running podcast.
Yeah. And by the way, Billy, my brother lives in LA and it's Thursday. I haven't touched base with him, but he's on strike. He's a screenwriter. And every Thursday he does his 8-mile run between the studios right now, striking with his. Wow. It's really hilarious.
Oh, nice.
And he's probably talking.
Yeah, I hope he's chanting some slogans. Yeah, I'll keep an eye out for him though. Does he look like you? Just like an older guy. Yeah.
Cool. He looks like he's a better runner than me. His form's better than me. His name's Larry, aka Scoob Stuckey, and he is awesome. He's doing that today.
Oh wow. Nice.
You talked about the Little Nell, and I know you also had I'll let you talk about it. Talk about your time at French Laundry. A little bit. I don't know if that felt like a jumping off point at all, or if prior to that did, or when did you know that you were going to stay in high-end hospitality, and what was that kind of transition like? And then we can maybe start talking more into the wine side, get into Friuli and those kinds of things.
Yeah. So I went to work in 1995 at the Little Nell, and I got to work under a food and beverage director at the time. She's now a managing director of the Ojai Valley in California. But at that time, she was the food and beverage director of the Nell. She was an alum of the Four Seasons. Her name was Connie Thornburg. And then her boss, also my boss, the general manager of the hotel, Eric Calderon, I went to work for them at the Little Nell. It was an incredible time to be at the Nell. Very supportive group of leadership and let me really grow into my position as a sommelier and then a wine director. And that was just so much positive energy. And I loved it. And I got to do so many great things and very creative things in the fine dining space. It let me feel very comfortable in that space to the point like, oh, I want to have this part of my career forever. And then from the Little Nell, I went to work for Thomas Keller and Laura Cunningham at the French Laundry, really at a very exciting moment at the French Laundry in 2000. A lot was going on then. And I found myself, luckily, in another very supportive environment. Thomas and Laura were amazing to work for. Could possibly be the easiest job I ever had. And this is contrary to what everyone thinks about the French Laundry. Now, was it hard? Was it a lot of intensity and a lot of hours? Of course. But the fact that Thomas and Laura could get the entire organization, at that time, maybe 100 employees, with the same vision every day, from whoever was the person raking the pea gravel in the garden, all the way up to Chef de Cuisine or me as wine director, everyone knew what our mission was. And when you have a team that aligned, yes, you have intensity. Yes, you have long hours, but it's a very special environment. That should be really, Thomas just did Guy Raz's How I Built This. He should really be teaching a class at Harvard Business School as leadership CEO of getting an entire 100 people on one path. It was amazing.
What are the, so can you dig into that a little bit and just, are there like tangible, I took this when you left, you took that to your next.
Yeah. I've tried to steal a lot of the, or not steal, I've tried to use a lot of what I saw. I think he's one in a million or one in a billion. There might not be another person in a billion people who's been able to do that for that long too.
Yeah.
I think he does, he and Laura both don't get enough credit for what they've instilled to have 30 years of that excellence is just, and getting everyone on that page. There's a lot to be said there. So of course I've tried to borrow ideas and think like that. It's really hard to do. It's a very singular type of leadership that you can borrow all you want, but if you can't do that every day, like it, the effect's not the same.
Yeah, we had Andre Houston Mack on as well, and he mentioned that similar quality and also how it translates across his different properties as well. So I think that's really interesting and something that I agree with you with, this is underappreciated. I do have one question about your time at the French Laundry. I have my trusty Amber Revolution book here, and you're quoted in there about trying to incorporate some of these Friuli wines. This might be our transition over. Yeah. How was it trying to incorporate some of those wines into that, in that menu?
As you've, since you've read the book, how it went down. First of all, that book is great. Really like the
fantastic
guy. He really delved into the whole Vini Maturati or macerated wine or orange wine, whatever you want to call it. Really.
You should tell him to come on the podcast.
We have to.
He's told me no so far.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll ping him. Do you have his email? I'll ping him and say how, what a great time I had.
Yeah, I'll CC you on a message.
The book's great. And he's, yeah. You, to read the book or to read that chapter and to think about what was going on in 2000, wine importers didn't have websites. Wineries, definitely in Friuli, did not have websites. No one did. It was very hard to get information. And I was already into Italian wines, already into Friuli. I had fallen in love with Grosvenor when I worked at the Little Nell before they were macerated, when Yasko made incredible barrel-inflected, textural white wines, either Pinot Grigio, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay. If you ever come across an auction item with those pre-macerated wines, they're really revelatory. So I loved him. I loved Radicon. I loved wines of Friuli already. So when I got to the long story, when I got to the Laundry, it was a mostly California Napa list. My job was to make it an all-world list. So as you put things of importance together, you got Piemonte, you got Tuscany, you might do Priorat for Spain, Rioja, blah, blah, blah. I put together some Friulano wines. And I remember this is when Radicon was first to market with macerated wines. Even though he and Grosvenor did it the same year, Grosvenor had some complexities where all in his amphora, everything, it wasn't sealed properly and he couldn't release a wine. So Radicon was the first one to be released. I was paying attention to that. And at that time, those wines were imported by Robert Chatterton, no website, very little information. My West Coast president of Chatterton was Alan Sobczak. And I remember pouring that first Radicon and everyone was like, what the? No one had seen an orange wine. Nobody. And it was hard to get information. And I was already a Friulano geek. The great thing about Napa at that time, two people were into those wines. John Konsgaard from Konsgaard. He was at that time the consulting like and winemaker enologist for Luna. And he was making a partially macerated PG before anyone was thinking about that. And his business partner in that was a guy named George Varr. And they were my only two people I got to talk to about those wines that understood Friuli Venezia Giulia. George Varr, rest in peace. A lot of the Ribolla or Schiappettino in Napa currently today are cuttings that he had brought over. He used to go over every December to celebrate his, I think it was his birthday, in Friuli with Serena from Ronco de Nemetz, and he was good friends with Stanko Radicon that we've lost, but those were the only two people I could really talk to in the country that I knew that were into those wines, and it was a great dialogue. And they capture that in Amber Revolution a little bit, but I can't tell you how wild that was to – it was like out of a different world. Now – people, there's orange wine stacked anywhere now in the world.
What is your perspective on, I guess there's two sides of my question here. One is, it's nice that it's gaining some traction and some of these wines are getting more of the prestige and appreciation that they should. But at the same time, there are some that are just lightly macerated out there, just plonk, to use a better word, that are just masquerading as orange wine. Do you think it's better that the category as a whole is being recognized? Or do you think that maybe it's losing a bit of its shine because of some of the lesser quality examples?
I think it's a two-point question. First, doesn't matter what style of winemaking you're making, oak inflected, stainless steel, champagne, whatever. If you don't do a good job, you don't do a good job, period. Mm. And our job as wine people is to understand when something isn't good. We didn't give hall passes in the early 2000s if a California producer over-oaked their Chardonnay. We had no problem saying, oh, I'm not going to say a producer, but that producer's over-oaked. We would never have a problem. It was never that visceral if someone didn't do a good job. The problem is with, I don't want to put it under the umbrella of natural wine or vini maturati or whatever you want to say, is our job is still to taste wine and make sure it's not flawed, that it's okay. A flaw could be over-oaked. A flaw could be residual sugar when it shouldn't have residual sugar. A flaw could be not clean, whatever it is, or with vini maturati, not done well. The one thing that should be even more critical, and as young wine tasters or old wine tasters like myself, really paying attention, is making macerated wine is hard to make it great. So maybe there should only be hall passes, and we should only exalt the really great ones because it's really hard to do. And I'm always fascinated with people who try to pivot and do that because of a trend. They don't realize how long Stanko and then his son Sasha, how long Yasko and his family and these producers, the Benza family at Castellata, they were doing this two decades before the trend hit, right? So they have to realize if you're new to the trend, you're two decades behind. Go get some information and find out how to make it really well done. It's amazing. The difference between great ones, average ones, and bad ones is so spread out. And our job is to really taste the great stuff.
Can you give some listeners just a little primer on Friuli? Just like 2 minutes, how it's positioned in the wine world, and then roll in maybe to your connection to the place and how that's working for you in your life right now?
I might start with my connection is very deep. I have my original restaurant that's 19 years old this summer, Frosca Food and Wine, is squarely based on the cuisine of Friuli Venezia Giulia. Mm-hmm. Real quick, for everyone out there, Friuli Venezia Giulia is this very magical, region, just north of Venice, at the top of the Adriatic. So it's the northernmost sandy beaches of the Adriatic, below Austria. So within 30 miles, you go from the beach to wine country. And then 20 miles later, within 50 miles, you're going into mountains that you have ski areas. So it is a very diverse region geographically, but also culturally. It is the western edge of Eastern Europe. So post-World War II, that's where Yugoslavia was. Friuli was on the border of what was Yugoslavia, but it's now back to Slovenia. It's the northern part of the Italian culture and the southern part of the Austrian culture. So Trieste was really the only port city, seafaring port city of the Austrian Empire that had a lot of influence. So you have these different cultures really living side by side for centuries. So it's very complex. So food-wise, culture-wise, wine-wise, very complex. Then wine-wise, the rest of the world is trying to catch up to Friuli on diversity. But I think about 20-some years ago when I lived in Napa Valley, if I had a winemaker friend of mine visiting from Europe and we went and saw three different Napa producers, they might be different wines, but the methodology was really the same. Friuli, and I think in the Galone's Vinius recap of Friuli this last quarter, he tries to get at that. The author gets at this of like how diverse Friuli is. I'll take it one step farther. It's been that way for a long time where you can see one producer in Oslavia that's Vini Maturati. You can go down the hill and you're at Schiappetto, very stainless steel, certain style. And then you go around the corner and you go see Due Del Monte and it's barrel inflected and it's all, they're all right in their philosophy. It's so diverse that way. But it's been that way for a long time where you've got this great winemaking diversity. It can be confusing for people if it's their first step in to that or their first foray, but it is really complex. And just be aware that sometimes the biggest megaphone isn't what's truly the most norm. And what I say about that is I think we all think Friuli orange wine to the max. But if you really think about it, Vini Maturati in Friuli is a very small subset in a mostly based around one small village of Oslavia with about 14 families making orange wine up there. It's very small. And then there's some producers in the Karst or over the hill in Slovenia, but it's not like the whole region's that way.
Yeah, I was, Brady, you can hop in here too in a second. But on that front, I had the pleasure of going last year. We stayed just literally across the border in Slovenia, and then we drove down to Venice. And that was something that I had been aware of, the skin contact wines, but I had not experienced a lot of the, I guess, all of the other styles at once. And I didn't realize how complex and unique they were. Why do you think that out of all of the regions and like with the immense success of Prosecco just next door, that some of these wines, especially some of the really vibrant mineral driven whites, or even some of the really interesting reds, haven't really made it over and weren't really appreciated as much? Was it more of like folks there trying to plant things that people knew for export purposes, or things like Schiappettino and Refosco that are coming back on the red side, and Friulano and Ribolla in terms of the white style? How come you think these aren't as big as they are well appreciated yet?
That's a great question, Billy. Let me tell you first, it's funny, next week in Aspen, Carlin Carr and I have two-part seminar based squarely on this, based on the misconfusion of, I think Friuli is interesting because for over 250 years, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Franc, Merlot has been a very historical piece of them there. And it's hard for young sommeliers. It's hard for wine journalists. We get it all wrong. They think because those varietals are not indigenous, people think they were planted for commercial reasons. That is absolutely not the truth. A lot of the indigenous varietals were really hard for farmers to work with 250 years ago. And so we're having a resurgence of, as you said, Schiappettino, which is amazing, or Refosco. and a little bit of Pignolo, but and Ribolla. But Ribolla really is great only on certain very steep sites or made in a crisp sparkling wine style. Ribolla is good in Oslavia for macerated, but it's not a Vendegard varietal the rest of Friuli. Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Franc is what I don't want to call it international versus indigenous. I think what we should call it is historical greater than indigenous. There is this historical precedent of these, what we people like to refer to as Frenchy varietals. They've been there as long as Napoleon came over. And they're really about the place there. And they're so historical for some of these winemakers. And that makes it really hard for sommeliers around the world that don't have that context and don't understand that. They really think it's a reaction to be marketing. And that is so far from the truth. There's a great email exchange that Carlin and I have had with Christian Patat, who is like the Giulio Gambelli of white wine in Friuli. He's Miani's only consultant he's used for almost 30 years. And he's, look, wine, grapes have been part of trade, economic trade and movement for thousands of years. The same monks that focused on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Burgundy, if you look at their monasteries across Europe, they were taking things back and forth all the time. So there's really very few truly indigenous wines, but we love talking indigenous. We love that buzzword. But look, these international varietals have been there for so long, and we just don't know how to articulate. We haven't done enough research. We're not well read enough on it. So yeah. I really think we should call it historical greater than indigenous.
I'm so happy you're having a session. I wish I could come to that. Because like when we were – I had done some reading ahead of time too, and I didn't realize how early – and I'd known the Napoleonic kind of trend of things, how much France had an influence on that area. And like the fact that there were like Merlot vines and others that were there for so long, it was validating for me because I had worked at a small producer here and their family had imported Italian wines for a while. And one of the – I had a Merlot from – the area, like from Friuli. And I was like, this is amazing. Who knew they just started making this? And then I read about it. And I think to your point, over that length of time, the vines can really acclimate to the terroir and evolve over time. And it really is their own kind of expression too. It's not like they're trying to make a Bordeaux Merlot or they're trying to make like a Napa Merlot. It's like their own actual thing as well.
Yeah. And one follow-up on that's very interesting, because if my wife listens to this podcast, she'll kill me. Half the world says Napoleon brought it. There was also a lore. Danette really likes this story better, and so I just got to say it. Historically, it lines up about the same time. Is there was a beautiful woman in the Loire that married a count in Friuli, and then she brought Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay to the hill of Rizzazzo, which is a very famous Grand Cru hill in Friuli, which Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, Pinot Bianco has literally thrived ever since. So there's two stories from about the same time period, but that just talks about how much these grapes interchanged for sure. And one other little known fact that freaks people out. On the western side of Friuli, there's a village named Rochedo. It's also a winery, a family cooperative of Rochedo. But most importantly for all of us in wine, it's really the most important wine nursery in the world and has been for almost 200 or over 200 years. There's been more clonal selection work there than anywhere in the world. They're still the most cutting edge. It's a fascinating idea. And a lot of people don't know this. After phylloxera, the people in the Loire didn't replant the Loire with material from France. It came from Rochedo. That's wild.
Oh, wow.
They went to Friuli to get Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Franc to replant Loire.
Huh. Wow. Yeah, I like that idea of historic over indigenous and this idea of diversity and true diversity and really wedged into this region so many varieties and expressions of these varieties. Thinking about how food and culture plays a role, what role has food from that region and dishes from that region that you've brought and been able to introduce at Frasca, how has that helped to tell the story of these wines? And what's the relationship between food and wine? I want to hear maybe the perspective as you've brought that to the States here in your projects.
It's really helpful for us. There's a lot of traditional dishes that we can connect mm-hmm. with wine at different parts of the meal that really feel so good and so authentic. And it tells the story of Friuli. And I'll start right at the, we have three pages to the menu. You have Comanciare. How do you begin? So two of the most important legs of the three-legged table of Friuli wine are on that first section, Prosciutto San Daniele and Frico. Frico is this dish made of Montasio cheese from the Carnic Alp. And then the third would probably be a glass of Friulano. So right there, you can really start a table off and make them fully Friulano-filed with a glass of Frico, which is Montasio cheese, steamed potatoes and sweated onions, and a slice of Prosciutto San Daniele. Right there, they get the whole Friulano experience before they've even gotten into the menu. So it's been really helpful. Other things that food and wine connections, I think, are so exciting. We have a lot of very herb, especially in the springtime, you have Uli is very important with white asparagus. There's that herb called sclopete, and making sclopete in a risotto or things like that, very herbaceous, and then connecting it to maybe Friulano Sauvignon Blanc or maybe a more fuller body glass of Friulano really connects with people. Friuli has a very interesting clone of Malvasia. It's called Malvasia Istriana. It's Malvasia. The Venetians took it from Greece all over the Adriatic and Mediterranean. Be really frank, it freaking sucks everywhere. Sorry. But it really got amazing on the Istrian Peninsula in the Ponca soil. Ponca is the soil that came out of the Adriatic. And when you taste Malvasia Istriana with pesce crudo, because we have a big raw fish culture, or with a seafood risotto, it is just, boom, really takes you there. And then any of those rustic reds like Rofosco or Pignolo, or more the high-toned reds like Schiappettino, those work really well with some of our roast meat sections or Ferrarona or game birds and things like that. So we get so many opportunities when we're really focused to tell the story of the table of Friuli Venezia Giulia.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love hearing how those two things come together to, like you said, transport people to that place. We were in Denver as a team. Our company was the end of last year?
It was whatever July, it was, I think.
But we actually got to go to Sunday Vine July last year, almost a year. We got to go to Sunday Vinyl and we drank some wine there. So you have these other projects as well. Singular thread through all of your different projects in terms of what you want to bring to the diner and where you want to transport them to, or how do some of your other restaurants differ in that way?
Yeah, Siska is very Friulano-filed. Right next door, Pizzeria Alberico is squarely rooted in the cuisine of pizzas of Naples. Tavernetta is a more broad swath of all of Italy. And then Sunday Vinyl is just really great food that goes great with the whole world of wine. So I always think of it as like great wine food. Clara, who's the lead sommelier there, is just so infectious. It's great.
Yeah, and the speaker setup was awesome. It was a good vibe in there. Was that your inspiration or
Yeah, I do vinyl and I like audio, but it really was an expensive move, not just to put it in there, but then to have my wife see it and go, hey, why do we not have that at home? So we're doing a remodel on our house this fall, and that has been brought up on multiple occasions of, I think she thinks her home listening should be as robust as the guests listening at Sunday Vinyl.
Yeah. I heard somewhere you're a former or still a punk rocker, or kind of what's your taste in music?
I'm an omnivore of music. I love all music. It could be as crazy as Ethiopian funk from the 70s to jazz to blues to rock and roll. but I will always, if I look at the breadth of all the music that has touched me for so long in my life, I still remember the first time I opened the original Clash album over 40 years ago. I still remember sitting on my parents had Murphy beds for my brother and I, and we had a split room, and I was sitting on there, and I went to my brother Scoob. I'm like, come in here, you got to listen to this. And the fact that the Clash has affected me from 1981 to 2023 equally, yes, I definitely have. I love punk rock. I love certain genres of punk rock, not all punk rock, but certain genres of punk I really enjoy. Going back to early punk, from if you think about Johnny Thunder and you think about things like the New York Dolls and what they brought, what Iggy Pop and the Stooges brought to people pre, I think a lot of us think punk rock started with the Sex Pistols and the Ramones, and that's quite not the truth. They were the second piece. Literally, the Sex Pistols were fully a ripoff of what was going on in New York City a few years before. So I like listening to some of that original stuff too.
Yeah, I think the pairing of wine and music is maybe the easiest bridge between like wine and other like subcultures. I think it's really awesome that you brought that kind of aspect to that project. That's really cool. Do you collect vinyls?
I do, robustly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So would you consider, do you collect anything else besides vinyls? So we're an investment firm, Wine Investment. And so we run across a lot of wine collectors who don't always take to wine investing that well, but we have to talk to them a lot. And so always interested in, do you consider yourself a collector of many things?
For sure. I think a collector is a gene, and you either have it or you don't. And yeah, a collector could be someone who, like myself, wants to find the original pressing of a Johnny Thunders album. Okay. Or my wife collects vintage clothing robustly.
Nice. Maybe
too robustly, if she's listening. Might want to work on the editing a little bit. But no, in all honesty, I'm joking about Danette, but she's very passionate about that. Together, we collect wine. And have since we got together. We've been married over 23 years. We also collect vinyl together. We also collect, not huge, but we're into it, first generation living artist ledger paper art. So ledger paper, first generation meaning indigenous people, Native Americans, is a form of art that was very big in the late 1880s called ledger paper. And that was when first generation people were put onto reservations, and there was a trading post with ledger paper. They would use that in the schools when they were learning, and people started, it was like the original graffiti. And it's really can be political. It can be fascinating. And we've collected, what we like to do now is collect living first generation artists, either from the Sioux Nation or wherever, that are doing modern takes of ledger work. So we try to save up, and maybe every 18 months can buy something like that.
That's awesome. Now, you said that you're maybe building out a new like speaker system and like music set up in your house. Is your whole house oriented around your collecting and things like that too? Because that's definitely how, if money goes into our home, it's probably going to be around the things that we've cluttered it up with, like wine and art and these kinds of things.
Yeah, the remodel will let us move between our collections more stress-free, I think.
Do you store wine at home?
Yes, I do. We have a wine cellar in the bottom of our basement.
So I assume, are you mainly collecting Italian wines, or do you have
affinities across the board? There's nothing better to keep you humble than to keep a little bit of wine for decades and see what was fascinating you 20 years ago. Is it still delicious? When it is, how exciting that is. Yes.
What do you know, how you go down to the cellar to pick something out and you pick it up a lot, but you can't open it, but you're excited to? What's one or two of those wines for you right now?
A couple years ago, we opened something we hadn't thought about For over 25 years, it was a bottle of Domaines & Humbrecht Pinot Gris Clos Jebsol. And it was so riveting. I was like, oh my God. And it took you back to that moment of when Alsace was in this inflection point where people were making riper style wines. And a lot of discussion in the mid 90s were, are these wines going to live? And for us to taste that and see it live like that was really revelatory for my wife and I. It's really special to talk about that wine now because I remember my first trip to Alsace was with a friend I worked with at the Nell, Alex Palmez, but with two California winemakers. This is in the mid 90s, Rob and Maria Sinsky of Robert Sinsky Vineyards. And I think this week or this month, they're closing on the family selling that estate. And I think about how awesome that visit was to DZH with them and Marcel Dice and things like that.
Nice. You have me really wanting to go up to Alsace now. I was going to ask, in your collection, what would you consider be the most kind of obscure or strange? Or, yeah, I'm a fan of weird varieties and strange regions. So what do you think?
Since I live in Freeport, I'm quite comfortable with weird. I do know that my wife has, and now that you reminded me, I'm going to bring this up to her next time we're looking at home. She has a very old bottle of Lagrange from Alto Adige from, I think it's from Nidaros, but it's 25 years old. I think that would be something we should probably open sooner than later.
Nice.
That's pretty nice. Cool. What are your domestic interests? And to wrap up the...
I love Ridge.
Wow.
I love Old Mondavi. Yeah. I love Old Turley. I think there's a lot to delve into there. Napa Cabernet with age is amazing. I think there's something, I don't think Tim Mondavi gets enough credit for how individual he was at the late 80s, early 90s, when the Napa movement was chasing Robert Parker and things like that. And Tim Mondavi was steadfast in what he was doing and doing in the late 80s, 90s, early 2000s, building huge Slavonian oak upright fermentation when everyone was going to barrique. That would be so of the moment now. He was literally three decades ahead. And if you ever get to try any of those wines, really exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah, Billy's actually from Virginia, and I spent some time in Virginia, and the winemaker at Barbersville in Virginia, Luca Passina. Do you know Luca?
Yeah, he makes Nebbiolo.
That's right. Yeah, Nebbiolo and Cab Franc is incredible. I love all their wines, but yeah, the Nebbiolo especially. Every time I taste there or drink those wines, I'm just like astounded at how well they're doing that stuff on the East Coast. I think that's really cool. And I'm on with you on Ridge. Ridge is my, I think the greatest producer in the U.S., but so good. Very good, Bobby. This has been awesome. I think we covered a lot of territory. I don't know, Billy, do you have anything else?
Oh, no, I'm just really happy you brought up Malvasia Istriana. We've actually showed so many friends here that they come to our house with bottles, and I make sure that it's Malvasia Istriana and not just all Malvasia, and I make them make it clear that they might not like all the other ones because they like the acid and some of the mineral. I'm just happy you brought that one up because it's a big fan of mine, or I'm a big fan of it.
Fantastic. One thing I might want to bring up that was on the Q&A, and maybe you can edit this in, is it was on your call sheet, is the effects of what was Yugoslavia, now Slovenia, what's going on there. I think it's really important to talk about is, look, the terroir in the Brda, which is the Slovenian Polio, one of the great regions of Friuli, overlaps into Slovenia. It's called Brda. Incredible deposits of Ponca soil there. Watch how great these wines are becoming over there in Slovenia. And it's a geopolitical historical deal. Look, communism is not great for world-class winemaking. It's just a fact of life. You can't have great winemaking in a communist country. And these guys and gals were stuck in that for so long. And now with each year that you go over there, it's just fascinating. I was just at the Brda tasting called Brda and Friends, where it's a Brda producer with someone outside of Brda. They could be from Italy. They could be from Romania. They could be from Croatia, wherever. They could be from France. And it was a really, that afternoon was really fascinating. There's so much good wine there. And it's just going to be, and not just in Berta, you go up into the Vipava Valley, what producers like Hidele is doing up there is, wow, so good. So there's lot to unpack there.
I'm happy you brought that up. I didn't know if we moved on quickly when we were talking about the general region. But yeah, we spent most of our time in Slovenia, and then we went down to Venice. Yeah, and tasting up through the Vipava Valley, I had a sparkling wine that was grown in the Vipava Valley that was like had 10 years on the lees, and it was one of the most interesting sparkling wines. But I don't think that people understood, like, when they made the border, it was behind the Iron Curtain. So like some of these winemakers had to go through checkpoints that were like miles away to get to the other side of their vineyards, or to bring grapes from their vineyards all the way around to where the wineries were. And of course, that's going to impact winemaking along with the collectivization of the property, the grapes in general. So that was only 30 years ago that they were allowed to open up again. So it's really exciting.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah. Great stuff. Guys, thank you so much.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I hope we got to cover stuff that you're excited about. It's awesome to hear about all the ways that I think really, especially if your restaurant's introducing people to stuff that I'm sure they wouldn't come into contact with or be able to pick up off the shelves themselves. And that's really, I think, what we want to see in the wine world. I'm also just my role at the company is in like investor relations, and Billy's a little bit more on the wine side. And really in terms of the way that we try and think about the way we relate to customers, I pulled a lot from your work just in terms of hospitality and going above and beyond expectations, which I think is something you exemplify well. So really appreciate and glad to have you on.
Thank you. I'll work on getting Simon Wolf on for you. Another great person you should have on is Carlin Carr, the wine director of our company. She is amazing. Okay. She'd be a great interview.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I think we want to do, or I'll speak for me, I want to do more like hospitality, restaurants, and like on-premise wine. And so we'd love to have someone
great
on. Awesome. Yeah, we'll make those connections. And Bobby, I hope you have a great summer, great rest of the year. Get to do some more traveling. And how often are you in Friuli?
About 3-4 times a year.
3-4 times. Okay. And you have a place there, so you get to spend extended.
No, but we stay with the Cirque family at La Sabita.
Oh, cool. Nice. Awesome. We were able to eat there when we went, and that whole property is amazing. Yeah. Talk about
there, good Friuli. My people right there. Yeah. I mean, nice. I feel very lucky to have my great connection with Mitya and Loredana and Tanya and Sandro and Yasko. They're amazing.
Will you bus tables there from your 70s on in Friuli?
Oh, yeah, for sure. They let me know all about it. Yes.
Awesome. Thanks, man. We'll be in touch. We'll stay in the loop. And yeah, again, really appreciate you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
See you, Bobby.
All right. Thanks for tuning in again for this week's episode of the Vint Podcast. Hope you enjoyed this interview from the archives with Bobby Stuckey. We look forward to seeing you back again next week. Cheers.